and then their kids come from here. And so she actually became a queen for a little while, brought in a lot of evil. You can see the effects of her dad and that whole family line of how they had just terrible allegiance to Baal and all these false gods. And so she brought that over. And so we got to this point here with Joash, where he made these reforms. And I think he's such an interesting character, specifically as we think about him in relation to the book of Chronicles as well. And this was our slide that we had from last time. And he is what we call one of the reforming kings. And I'll pull that chart back up in a minute where we can see the trajectory of all these different kings and how they line up with doing what is good. But these are just the bare facts about him that we made reference of. He became king after he was stashed away in the house of the Lord, being protected, and he was trained up by a priest. And I think there's this really interesting correlation. There's another king that we'll make reference of today, that when they spend time with a priest in Jerusalem, in the house of the Lord, they become a good king. Now, that should be an obvious fact if we understand what we're saying. The more time you spend with God and God's people, the better off you will be. These men that make reforms, that make changes, as in they come in, and he specifically comes in, does away with his mother and all the false abominations that she introduced into Judah. He gets rid of those, and he starts building up the temple itself. And there's some issues that arise along the way, and I've got references all throughout here where you can see it from Chronicles as well as Kings, that he's getting this big storehouse of money to try and build up the temple. They kind of halt for like 20 years. They don't do anything at all. And he comes in, he's like, fine, I'm just going to start paying the workers directly. The priests were supposed to be in charge of it. You guys kind of failed in that. So I'm just going to start paying the workers outright. And so they eventually build up the temple in a better state than it was in, because it keeps getting pillaged, or they keep letting it go to disrepute. And so he comes in and he does a lot of good with it. I think it's interesting as you look at 2 Chronicles chapter 24, as we read Kings, you find out, all right, how did this guy kind of taper off at the end? He's still considered a good king, follows after God, but he has a time in his life where he ventures away from God's plan. And what goes on here is that he allows his heart to be turned away for a little while. But overall, he's still considered a good king, but he is this reformer that is doing what is right. So Israel is being built up as a nation. They are doing a lot of good, fixes the temple. And that's one of the distinctions between Israel and Judah, is that Judah has Jerusalem. They have the temple where God's name can be found. What does Israel have? They have Samaria, where Baal and his altar is found. And then they have the two sins of Jeroboam, the north and the south, Dan and Bethel, where people are going to worship another god, a replacement of God and what he has designed. They've completely done away with God's plan. So that's what's going on here with Joash and Jehoash, if you switch those names in and out. There's going to be another one that we're going to see today where there's a crossover of names, but that's just what we get to deal with something like this. So I did want to make a mention of him as a reformer that's going to be leading us into this comparison of this, you know, rapid-fire succession of the kings that we're going to be seeing today that's leading to Israel's demise. And I will make one more reference of this up here. There's going to be a time where you're coming down through here. You're going to have some kings that are actually going to have the same name as kings over here. So it's just another one of those times. It's going to pop up one more where you're going to have two identical named kings. One's in Israel, one's in Judah. Don't get confused in the story. Try and differentiate between those as much as possible. And if that's not challenging enough, their names are also replaced. So sometimes you'll see Uzziah, sometimes you'll see something else. And so try and organize them as best you can. That's why it's important to come back to charts like this and really slow down as you read to see the difference. But we're also going to be getting to the end of Jehu's dynasty. And I thought it was interesting. Did you guys pay attention when Josh was speaking on Sunday? He was reading from Hosea chapter 1. Did you see the reference of Jehu in that reading? And it talked about the bloodshed that Jehu had, that it would come back onto his house. Although Jehu was a reformer that did these good things on behalf of God, where God told him, I need to come in and wipe out the family line of Omri, he causes a lot of blood spill, but Jehu ends up falling away. And so God comes back to him and said, you know, all the evil that, or all the things that you did, although you were doing them on my behalf, it's actually going to come back on you because you didn't turn your heart in the right direction. And that's kind of a reoccurring theme that you'll see as well, where although someone may do good, it will get reversed back on them if they reverse their allegiance. So just be aware that this is where we are coming back to this today. So catching up with our first king of the day, looking at Israel, we're going to be in 2 Kings chapter 13. I'm going to mostly be focusing on these fast fact cards, and we'll make reference as we need to throughout these passages. But we're going to look from chapter 13 to chapter 17 and make reference from there. I'm mostly going to leave chapter 17 in your hands because it's going to be a description of everything leading up to that point where Israel is going to be blacked out. They're not going to be in existence anymore. And what we're watching as we go through the kings today is this percolating of evil that keeps coming along, where we're going to see some really horrendous sins that's going to result in the death or the conclusion of Israel as a nation. So we have Jehoahaz. He is still underneath the family line of Jehu, and that's our dynasty or our household. He's the first son here. Jehoahaz became king after his father Jehu dies, and God's anger was kindled against him because he did not depart from Jeroboam's sins. If you haven't seen that once, then you certainly have seen it 500 other times. Therefore, God sent Syria against Israel as a punishment. It's so intriguing as you watch how God operates his arm of judgment. There's going to be multiple references specifically today in our study, in our reading, where it talks about judgment being pronounced against this person or against this nation. How does God stretch out his arm of judgment? Sometimes it comes in the form of a king. Sometimes it comes in the form of a nation. Sometimes it's letting sin just run its natural course that it has a conclusion to it that is detrimental to someone's life. But there's always going to be this reference that God allowed them to enter into this. There are times where God will, he's not causing them to sin. That's not the case at all. But he uses their momentum to take them where they need to be. There's multiple servants, servants of God that come from pagan nations where it's God saying, look, I'm actually in control of this. I'm trying to teach you a lesson, and if you will turn back, then everything will be okay. And what's interesting about Jehoahaz is that he is being taken over by Syria, but we start to find at least some times where we're reading today where we're thinking, they're so close to coming back. Israel, the northern tribes that have been completely separated from God, they're almost back. Let's look at this in 2 Kings. We'll start reading in verse 4. So he's got this army that's coming in of Syria in verse 4. Then Jehoahaz sought the favor of the Lord, and the Lord listened to him. For he saw the oppression of Israel, how the king of Syria oppressed them. Of these times, and we're still going to have to call him an evil king because he did do what is evil, and you're going to find, although he's making progressive paths toward God, you've got this negation of it because of his devotion to the sins of Jeroboam. But he sought God's favor. This is what we call the Judges cycle. When you read the book of Judges, you'll find where people will turn away from God. God sends in an enemy. They call out to God. God sends in a savior or a judge to help them. They come back to God, and then they fall away, and they keep going in this cycle. And we have an introduction of it here almost in the same way. In verse 5, therefore the Lord gave Israel a savior so that they escaped from the hand of the Syrians, and the people of Israel lived in their homes as formerly. Now, when it says the word savior, and there's a couple of different terms that you could swap in and out of there, but that's essentially what's related to a judge, or what is related to someone that is leading the people. Even the name Joshua, the name Jesus, both of those coming from the same Hebrew foundation mean a savior, someone that's going to come in and be a strong arm that's going to fight on behalf of God and the people. It just says there is a savior that comes. We don't know who it is. We don't know exactly what they do, but we know that it's directed by God. Even in the horrible things that are going on, God still has this plan where he's like, if you'll turn back to me, I'll take care of you. And he starts showing this. And you're going to see this elsewhere. Look at 2 Kings chapter 13, verse 23. Now, Hazael, the king of Syria, oppressed Israel all the days of Jehoahaz, Verse 23, but the Lord was gracious to them and had compassion on them, and he turned toward them because of his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and would not destroy them, nor he cast them from his presence until now. Now remember, the writer of 1 and 2 Kings is over here looking back at the history of Israel and Judah, and he's asking and answering the same question, how did we get here? We know, especially by our lesson today, that Israel's coming to an end. The northern tribes are coming to an end. It's going to be them led into exile by the Assyrians. All that's going to happen. And look at that reference here, that God showed compassion to them, and he turned toward them because of the covenant, because of the promises that he made. He's not going to negate those at all. And he would not destroy them. But there is a until now. And you want to know, how did we end up here? If he's doing these great things here, how did we still end up there? What's the next verse for us back? Let's see, we can also look at, I've got another reference on here. Chapter 14, 26 and 27. For the Lord saw that the affliction of Israel was very bitter, for there was none left, bond or free, and there was no one to help Israel. But the Lord had not said that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven. So he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. It's going to be another Jeroboam, by the way. But just a couple of different references how God is still trying to help them along this way. But the issue comes from 2 Kings chapter 13. If we're following in line with the text, we read verse 4. Let's read verse 5. Therefore the Lord gave Israel savior, so they escaped from the hand of the Syrians, and the people of Israel lived in their homes as formerly. And here's our word in verse 6, right? Underline it. Nevertheless, they did not depart from the sins of the house of Jeroboam, which he made Israel to sin, but walked in them, and the Asherah also remained in Samaria. Every time that nevertheless pops up, it's like they're doing so good, and we're going to see a couple of kings of Judah who do good, but then there's the nevertheless. For Israel, and the big deal for them is that they still have Dan and Bethel. They still have those golden images. Jehu did come in and he wiped out some of the Baal worship, but there was still the Asherah, the female counterpart of it. They still did not eradicate all the evil. But what God is trying to tell Israel to do is come back to Jerusalem where my name can be found. Not just so that you can have brick and mortar. That's not the case at all. He's saying, you guys are trying to establish these things over here in a false name and a false understanding, but you need to come where my name can be found, because this is where I am meant to be worshipped. This is where I've asked you to worship me. This is where, if you will seek me, I will be found. It's a change of heart that would lead them to this point over here. Because we're going to find as we go through Israel, what is their big hang-up? What is the nevertheless that's usually attached to the king of Judah? Nevertheless, they didn't remove the high places. They had up here, along with Jerusalem, they had these high places. The difference between Israel and Judah is that they're still over here trying to worship God while still having a hand into the world with these pagan practices. And he's saying, you got to relinquish that control and fully devote to me. What you have over here with Israel is a complete rejection of the place of where God is meant to worship. And as long as they stay divided, as long as they stay away, there is no hope for them until they come back home. And that's kind of the story of the post-exile that our series won't cover at all. But when the people of Israel collectively come back home to build the temple, God's favor comes back to them and tries to help them collectively as a nation. So Jehoahaz, he does good in this respect that he seeks after God and wants his help. Although God helps Israel, Jehoahaz still gets caught up in Jeroboam's sins, as we just saw. And so if you see these reoccurring themes, the sin of Jeroboam and the heart not being corrected, that's one of the things that's going to be pinpointed a little bit later on of why did you go into exile? It says your heart was never right. If you would have denounced your pride over here, you could have come home and we would have been together. But now you are completely removed from where you need to be. So there's Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu. We're still going to stay in line with Jehu as a dynasty, as a family. But this is going to be the next one in line here. Jehoash He followed in the sins of Jeroboam and did not stop walking in them. If you were going to trace down this exact wording, there's multiple times that it appears, and you could probably do it really quick with a search, but I like objectives as I'm trying to read through a text. If you look at 2 Kings chapter 13, verse 11, he also did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin, but he walked in them. Look at how many times that exact same description is given to a king. It's not only identifying their reputation, which is they did evil. It's not only identifying where the evil came from, that it spawns from Jeroboam, but it also has this legacy attached to it, that Jeroboam caused the people to sin. And this leader, just like Jeroboam, walked in this path. I think about Psalm chapter 1 every time I see that. Are you going to walk in the way of sinners, or are you going to walk in the way of righteousness? Are you going to be a tree planted by the waters that's going to grow up and flourish, or are you going to be like a tumbleweed that has no root and just going to be blown around left and right because you have no foundation at all? And so he has the reputation of being a bad king. But something else that we're told about here in Kings that is then explained further in Chronicles is this in verse 12. Now the rest of the acts of Joash, which you can either call him Jehoash or Joash, so two names changed out there, and all that he did, and the might with which he fought against Amaziah, king of Judah, are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Israel? That's kind of the end of it. That's all that they say about him. But I think it is of note to look at how 2 Chronicles explains what this fight was between Amaziah and Jehoash. Really, this is going to be God giving a judgment to the king of Judah by using the king of Israel. Let's just read a few verses here that I've got referenced. Let's go to 2 Chronicles chapter 25, verse 20. I know we're studying Kings, but you got to have Chronicles as well. 2 Chronicles 25, verse 20. Says this, but Amaziah, which is the king of Judah during this time, would not listen. For it was of God in order that he might give them into the hand of their enemies because they had sought the gods of Edom. Now, this description is really about Amaziah, is that he was seeking after some other gods. But it's in line with our king here of God using him as a form of judgment. There's other times that this same kind of language appears. Look at 2 Chronicles chapter 24, verse 24. Though the army of the Syrians had come with few men, the Lord delivered into their hand a very great army because Judah had forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers. Thus they executed judgment on Joash. I told you, you're going to see this reoccurring theme of judgment. Sometimes it's by the hand of a pagan nation, like Syria, or what we're going to see as Assyria later on, or it might even be a brother. You've got Israel and Judah fighting together. And so as you go through the story of Jehoash, you actually find that he is being a representative, or at least he is aiding where God needs him to go in order to get Judah back on path of where they need to be. So God was helping Jehoash like he helped his father Jehoaz. The same way Jehoaz said, you know, God, I'm seeking your favor. I need your help. I need to pursue you. So God comes in, sends a savior, whatever that may be, and helps him. In the same way, God helps Jehoash that we see here by defeating the Syrian kings and allowing him to recover cities in Israel. And you can see this reference back in 2 Kings chapter 13. In verse 24, when Hazael, king of Syria, died, Ben-Hadad, his son, became king in his place. Then Jehoash, the son of Jehoaz, took again from Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, the cities that he had taken from Jehoash, his father, in war. Three times Joash defeated him and recovered the cities of Israel. Essentially, just take note here. God is helping him. You get the fuller description that God is for a time helping Israel accomplish their goals, but they still don't fix the problem. And you can get the full context by looking at Chronicles. But for our short description that we find in 2 Kings chapter 13 of Jehoash, you want to take note of this, that he kept walking the sins of Jeroboam. He fought against Amaziah, and he fought as a servant of God, but he still didn't correct the problem. Now, so that's him sitting over here. He's going to appear in our story again because we're going to shift and we're going to look at this king of Judah. But I do want to take this path and highlight it. I pulled in the wrong graphic, but you can still read it. Just remember, I swapped revival out for reform. As we've been going on, this is just the kings of Judah. It's talking about 2 Chronicles here, but it also applies for 1 and 2 Kings that we're examining. You'll have kings that are described as evil, and this will lead to kings who are good. But the difference between a good king and a reforming king is that they go in and they try and remove the high places, and they try and completely eradicate all the false worship. And Jehoshaphat was one of them. And we find the decline here of Jehoram and Ahaziah and Athaliah. Then we pop back up to Joash, which we just made reference of today, where he fixed the temple. He saved up funds for it. We've got these other good kings, and it's not in declining order. It's just for the sake of our graph, okay? So we've got Amaziah, Uzziah, and Jotham. There's going to be our next three kings that we're going to examine here. They're going to be called good kings of Judah, but they still have this nevertheless component to them. They still don't get rid of all the evil that is around, although they are doing great good. And you're going to come to Ahaz, and he's going to be bad. Where we get to next week, we're going to talk about Hezekiah, and then we'll kind of bounce from here. So I wanted to put that back up here so you can see these next three kings of Judah specifically are going to be considered good kings, but there's still that nevertheless about them. Okay, so are y'all ready? Let's talk about this king of Judah. As all of our kings, he's still within the Davidic reign. There is not this replacing of others. There's not these removing of family lines. There was a promise that was given to David that was really given to Judah way back of you will always have a king that will sit on the throne. Let's go to 2 Kings chapter 14. This is going to be our main text to understand this king here, Amaziah. Let's get just a few descriptions about him. We'll jump down to verse 3. 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 3. And he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, yet not like David his father. There's the distinction. What we know about David, he had a heart fully dedicated to God, wholly dedicated to God. And although we have good kings, if you have yet not like David, what essentially they're saying is he didn't become one of these reformers. He still had something that was prohibiting him from going all the way in his allegiance. He did in all the things as Joash, his father, had done. There's going to be another one of these descriptions. You have they did good like David. And you also have they did good like their father. And this is a good representation of him. He said, look, you did good like your dad, just not as good as David that made him stand out differently. So here's the thing about him. He did not remove the high places or prohibit sacrifices and offerings from being made on them, as you see in verse 4. The people still sacrificed. Now, the king can try and make things right, but if he's not going to lead the people, he fails. That's that sticking point again. You keep allowing the people to do this. Had he come in and removed all the high places and told everybody, you stop worshiping all these places, just because he gives them the commandment doesn't change the people's hearts. They have to do that individually. The prophets that are happening during this time now are the ones that we get at the back end of our Old Testament. Specifically, when you read Jeremiah, you read Ezekiel, you read Malachi, they're concerned about people's heart. And they give this thought that's going to spread to the point of Jesus where they say, there's coming a time where God will replace the hearts of stone with hearts of flesh. And how much do we see in the New Testament, not just with Jesus, but also with all of the writings in the New Testament, that our heart has to change? We have to circumcise our heart. It's not just this physical act, because the Jews, they would identify themselves as a Jew by going through the process of circumcision. They say, look, I'm a Jew, but their heart's not right. Then what is it? Jesus will get on to the Pharisees in Matthew chapter 23, and he says, you guys are just looking at the outside of the cup, the outside of the plate, but you're not cleansing the inside. You look like a whitewashed tomb, but on the inside, you're full of dead men's bones. Yeah, you go into your spice cabinet and you'll tithe everything that you've got, but you've rejected some of these greater things that comes from the heart. And that's why Jesus will say in Matthew chapter 15, one of my favorite dialogues that he has with the people, he tells them, you guys are so concerned about traditions and you're elevating traditions to commandments, and that's not the case at all. You have to actually watch the heart, because it's not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person. He said, yes, you're following all the religious rites. You got to wash your hands. You can't eat certain things. That's all what God commanded for a time, but you've missed what the purpose of this is. God says, you know, don't eat, don't taste, don't handle, all this kind of stuff. It was to train you not to touch sin. Things that God says don't get anywhere near, you should have a rejection of that. And so in Matthew 15, he gets on to the Pharisees. He said, you've been focused on all these traditions. It's not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, because that's going to go into your stomach and that's going to be expelled. That's Jesus' own words. He says, but it's what comes out of the heart that defiles a person. The heart needs to be fixed. Okay, yeah, good question about the high places. The high places are these other altars that they have made. Some of them are to other gods. So there's these references of Baal and Chemosh and Molech and some of these other gods. It seems like, if you look at these references, it's interesting, because I was looking for some articles to describe the difference between Jeroboam's sin of Dan and Bethel and the difference between a high place. What would happen with these high places is that it may be an altar to another god, or it might just be another location where they're trying to offer sacrifices. So they'd say, okay, instead of going all the way up to Jerusalem to offer this sacrifice, I'll have a localized place here on top of this hill, but then at some points I'll go to Jerusalem as well. So it was almost like a satellite altar is how they saw it at times, but sometimes they were actually for false gods, where they would offer sacrifices on there to Baal, to Chemosh, to Molech, and some of these other places. And so that's what a high place is. It's just another location to offer sacrifices. Because if you look at some of the kings, I'm trying to think which one it was. I think it was Solomon. We are told about Solomon that he offered sacrifices on those high places to God. But that's not where you're supposed to offer a sacrifice. You're supposed to come to Jerusalem to offer a sacrifice there. So, Wayne, I appreciate that question. That's a good one. And so, for this king and what he's trying to do, he does a lot of good, but he doesn't remove the high places, and he doesn't fix the heart problem that is really the plague of men. Now, some other facts about him. When the royal power was firm in his hand, so he becomes king at kind of young, and he starts establishing his reign. So when he fully has control is what that's saying. He killed his father's executors. The way that his dad died was there's this conspiracy against him, and some of it was a fulfillment of his sin that came on him. But one of the first things that Joash does when he becomes strong, when people actually listen to him, he goes and finds these people who killed his father. He kills them. But this is where it's of interest. But did not destroy their children in order to honor the law of Moses. If you sin, you're going to be punished. God says, I'm not going to punish your children for what you do. And there's some references that I have here following it. We're not going to read all of them, but you can take note of them. This is the original commandment. Talking about not killing children for their father's sin. And then there's this description in Jeremiah and Ezekiel that I just made reference of, talking about the heart. And what these two prophets, Jeremiah and Ezekiel, are doing in conjunction with this, each one of you is independently accountable. Now, there's still consequence of sin, though, right? You see that Jehu said, you know, when he starts sinning, he does some things, although he's doing good for God. God still says, look, I'm not going to destroy your household yet, but it's coming in four generations because of what you did and what your children are going to do. There's always a physical consequence to sin, but the spiritual consequence of it is each person individually. And that's reinforced here because we're each accountable for our own heart. So he comes in and he kind of cleans house in this way. And after he succeeds in some great military conquest that we have a reference of in 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 7, that is then further explained in Chronicles, he decides to pick a fight with Israel. I think this is where he does a lot of good. And the way that Chronicles describes it is that he becomes prideful. What does Proverbs say? Pride comes before a fall. So he comes in, and I think this is an interesting dialogue. Look at 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 8. Just to stay in our context here, but Chronicles bears out the same narrative. Then Amaziah sent messengers to Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, son of Jehu, king of Israel, saying, "Come, let us look one another in the face." He said, "I'm going to take you down. Let's appear together. You and I are going to go toe-to-toe. We're going to fight." And Jehoash, king of Israel, sent word to Amaziah, king of Judah. "A thistle of Lebanon sent to a cedar of Lebanon, saying, 'Give your daughter to my son for a wife.' And a wild beast of Lebanon passed by and trampled down the thistle." So there's his little story, if that makes sense to you. Okay, here's what he's saying with it. Verse 10, "You have indeed struck down Edom, and your heart has lifted you up. Be content with your glory and stay at home. For why should you provoke trouble so that you fall, you and Judah with you?" So Amaziah's like, "Man, look, man, I've done a lot of good." It's interesting, when you read Chronicles, it tells us of all of his forces. It tells us how many soldiers he had, the battles that he fought with those soldiers. He almost looks invincible, and he's like, "Man, I'm, you know what? I'm just going to pick a fight with Israel. Like, let's just go fix them," because, you know, they keep clashing together, that civil war. And so he tells him, he said, "All right, come on, we're going to fight together. You get down here, we're going to talk about this." The king of Israel comes back, he's like, "Dude, you're not going to win. I'm sorry, like, that's just not the case. And if you come and appear, you're going to die, and it's also going to go really bad for Judah. Just don't come up here, because it's going to be a big embarrassment, but it's also going to be really bad. It's going to be a total bloodbath." And that's exactly what happens. Look at verse 11. "But Amaziah would not listen." What we don't see in Kings, but what we see in Chronicles, is Amaziah has started some idolatry. He fought against the king of Edom that was referenced here, and he borrowed their god. He started trusting in other gods. He had done a lot of good with God on his side. That's how he fought all these battles. You just see in verse 7, it just said, here are the things that he did. You read Chronicles and you find out, oh, the reason why he was so successful is because God was with him, fighting with him. But when he borrowed a god from these other lands, the downward spiral starts happening. So Amaziah would not listen because he's so prideful. He thinks he's got it figured out. So Jehoash, king of Israel, went up, and he and Amaziah, king of Judah, faced one another in battle at Beth Shemesh, which belongs to Judah. And Judah was defeated by Israel, and every man fled to his home, pummeled, sent home with their tails tucked between their legs. And Jehoash, king of Israel, captured Amaziah, king of Judah, the son of Jehoash, son of Ahaziah, at Beth Shemesh, and came to Jerusalem and broke down the wall of Jerusalem for 400 cubits from the Ephraim gate to the corner gate. And he seized all the gold and silver and all the vessels that were found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house, also hostages, and he returned to Samaria. He wasn't lying. He told you, he said, "All right, fine. If you pick a fight with me, I'm going to kill you. I'm also taking your home." So he marches in, tears down part of the wall, goes and gets the riches out of the temple, with some hostages, and he goes back home, and he sits in his throne of Samaria, and he said, "Told you. Had you listened, not just to him, but to God." Because what did we learn about Jehoash? God was using him to humble Amaziah. But Amaziah would not listen because he was too prideful. Now, this is something else if you want to study, and it's kind of reoccurring now, is that look at how many times either one, Jerusalem is pillaged, or two, where Judah gives away the treasures of the temple to pacify another king. Gone are the days of Solomon where he built up the temple and everything was overlaid in gold, and you had armor that was built up strong, and you go and you see all these great things. Gone are those days. We've actually saw very shortly after Solomon, as in his son Rehoboam, where Rehoboam is pillaged. Treasures are taken from the temple. It does not look like Solomon's temple. Now, it has the bare bones. It's got the structure of it, but the rest of it is certainly not the way it originally was. And time again, people give over the treasures of God, the things that are found in his storehouse, to appease, or they're just absolutely taken over by someone else. So Amaziah, although he does a lot of good, he does allow his heart to venture away for a while, but he still is in that nevertheless category. And so we find here his death at the hand of one of the kings of Israel. Now, as we pop back over to the story of Israel, we're going to see this kind of a rapid-fire succession of their kings. There's going to be another Judah king that's going to pop in line, but each one of these is going to have a very short reference to them. They don't last long because they keep sinning. And we're going to see very shortly where the house of Jehu is going to come to an end, as God promised, and it happens with conspiracies. It happens with assassination plots. They just don't last long. Jeroboam the second, not to be confused with the first, we read a verse from him earlier. He becomes king after his father dies. He kept walking the sins of Nebat. And although God is still fighting for them, there's this reference here. If you'll go and read these verses, 25 through 27, but also 2 Kings 10 through 32, if you're watching, God is kind of constricting Israel where he starts removing parts of the land from them. His judgment keeps closing them in and closing them in where they just don't have very much. But every time somebody tries to do what is right, God has compassion on them, he loosens those bonds a little bit. They can breathe a little bit more. And so during Jeroboam's reign, although he's still considered evil, because of God's promises, as we saw, he loosens the restrictions. Israel's borders are starting to expand a little bit more. They think that things are going well. God, you know, is trying to help them, but then it's going to come and collapse on them later. But that's about the only reference that we have of Jeroboam II. Our other king of Judah, Azariah, also known as Uzziah, depending if you're reading Chronicles or if you're reading Isaiah chapter 1. Isaiah is a prophet during this time as well. He becomes king after Amaziah was killed by a conspiracy plot and some other things that were going on that we saw here, but also out of Chronicles. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord according to all that his father Amaziah had done. There's that tradition. You're not quite like David, but you are like your father who was good. We'll take it. He had great military accomplishments, but he allowed his pride to lead him to destruction as well. And because of that, God made him a leper. He was excluded. He had to go stay in a house by himself. And his son is going to become king after him. We pop back to Israel, and this is, like I said, we've just got these short references that are all just leading us slowly downhill. Well, quickly at this point is how it feels. Because each one of them is not going to reign for very long. It's only a few months, maybe a year. There's some larger sections in there. Jeroboam II actually had one of the largest times where he was reigning. Zechariah, not to be confused with the prophet that you find in the Old Testament, he becomes king after his father Jeroboam, and he continues to do evil just like everyone else. But the extra note for him, he did evil as his fathers had done. He is the last heir of Jehu's dynasty. God told Jehu, you got four generations, and then you're going to be cut off. And so he's going to be killed according to a conspiracy plot, which is just reoccurring for each one of them. And so the guy that kills him is Shalom. Shalom becomes king after he assassinates Zechariah. And he's assassinated by Menahem, the son of Gadi. That's about the only references we have for them. Then you have Menahem, the son of Gadi. He becomes king after this assassination. He has a reputation of wicked acts, which contributes to Israel's further spiral downhill towards destruction. But during his reign, Israel's main threat begins to shift from Syria to Assyria. If you know your Israelite history, when Assyria comes up, this is a rough group of people. When they fight somebody, they don't just kill you. They take captives away. They'll flay you alive. they will put hooks in your nose, they'll strip you down naked, and they'll lead you out somewhere else. That's what's coming. And so when Assyria comes to the top, Israel's watching them, trying to help them. So they go in, and they're going to get all these riches to try and give to them to appease them for a little while. Assyria will go away, but they're eventually going to come back. Menahem's dynasty only lasts one more generation. His son, Pekahiah, comes in, and he becomes king, and everything starts going downhill further, where he gets assassinated. The assassination comes from Pekah, and this will take us, and we're just going to jump to this. I'm not going to read it. You just have it in front of you now. It takes us to 2 Kings chapter 17, where Israel is taken to exile. If you want to answer the question why, read this chapter. It'll break your heart because it broke God's heart. So I appreciate you holding on. Sorry we didn't get through all of those. I'll have those loaded up so you can have those fast facts cards. But this is the end of Israel. We're just going to be focusing on Judah the rest of the time. So appreciate you guys being here. Sorry we rushed that last part.